Okay, welcome. This is our 37th class. It is this week's a double parsha, Matot Masai. We're going to focus on full section of the last parsha, which is last parsha of the book of Bamidbar. Okay, so we're going to get, the title is, when is an accident not an accident? So we're going to go to a video. Here we go. I think hopefully this will be a little better. Let's see, look at the share screen. Boom, here we go.
A new warning tonight from the American justice system that distracted drivers will be treated as criminals. A landmark verdict in Massachusetts today convicted a driver of vehicular homicide, and his crime was blamed on texting while driving. The significance reaches far beyond this one case, and here's ABC's Amy Robach.
Negligent operation. Two families tearful when the verdict was read today.
Guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
Massachusetts Judge Stephen Albany then imposed the maximum sentence, 2.5 years behind bars, on 18-year-old Aaron DeVoe for texting and driving, causing a head-on collision that killed 55-year-old Daniel Bowley. Today, speaking softly, DeVoe apologized. This after the victim's daughter tearfully addressed the court.
I would wake up at night and hear my dad talking to you. Get up and go look for him. He wasn't there.
DeVoe will also lose his license for 15 years, a license he only had for 5 months prior to the fatal accident. Phone records show he received 4 text messages in the minutes before the crash. The last two at 2:34 and 2:35 p.m. According to prosecutors, the collision occurred at 2:36.
You weren't distracted by the cell phone you were using in texting.
That is my testimony, yes.
But each text takes a driver's eyes off the road for approximately 4.6 seconds. It's like driving an entire football field blindfolded. Look at this bus driver. One glance down at his phone, enough to distract him and cause this crash. 39 states plus the District of Columbia now ban texting while driving.
What kind of precedent does this verdict set?
It makes it clear that prosecutors are going to pursue charges against people who are texting while driving, and it shows that juries are ready, willing, and able to render a guilty verdict.
And we are now seeing state after state increase the criminal penalties for what you do behind the wheel. And Diane, we saw today the judges are more than willing to punish those offenders.
Saying enough is enough. But let's run through again what can get you a criminal penalty. We know about drugs. We know about drinking.
That's right. We've seen cases of drivers convicted of homicide when they get into a fatal crash while using their cell phones. Today's texting verdict obviously takes that a step further. And one state, New Jersey, has specifically made it illegal to drive while drowsy. So you could be charged with homicide if you kill someone while asleep at the wheel.
But one state says now sleepiness,
yes,
and an accident.
Get some coffee and get some rest.
And put you in jail. Okay, thank you so much, Amy Robach.
Okay. All right, so... all right, so a little sobering. Let's go to the All right, so we have, this was the video, just to recap, this was back in 2012, and since that there have been a number of states who have convicted people for vehicular homicide for killing people by them getting to an accident, by them reading or responding to a text message. Okay, and he killed this guy, David Bowley, who was a 55-year-old guy with a father of 3 kids. So I'm going to be open here that I, of course, certainly at a stop sign or traffic light have done a quick text myself. Has anybody else texted while driving?
Yes.
Yeah, I've read text messages, but I try not to reply to them.
All right. So that's good. Now, did you ever feel that you were committing a crime? I mean, did you have that feel of committing a crime?
No, I mean, it's not like I didn't feel like, you know, I'm robbing a bank. Like, I know this is wrong. It's more like, I'm trying to think of the word. Like, not like a criminal act.
So the question is, well, why not?
I guess it's just, you know, you grow up, you know, like, don't steal, but like, you grow up, you know, not to like text and drive.
How would you feel about having 5 drinks and then driving?
Bad. I wouldn't do that.
No, I understand it. I understand that. But you notice that emotionally, for example, so the campaign of not drinking and driving has been sufficiently effective that we're now conditioned, knowing that our life would be ruined and we'd hurt or kill other people, that we wouldn't do that. But the texting or phone use has not hit that threshold yet.
Right. But
now the question is, why did the jury convict Aaron DeVoe?
Because someone died.
He didn't intend to kill David Bowley.
Was it like, there's no lawyers in here. Was it like involuntary manslaughter?
Involuntary manslaughter. No.
Negligent operation.
Neither manslaughter.
Okay.
But I don't know why that gets 2 years, got 2 years and 15 years of losing your license for 15 years. So, why did the jury convict him? He was just reading a text.
Because of his actions, it caused someone to lose their life. It was like such an egregious crime. Like, it was so extreme that they had to charge him and sentence him to send a message to other people. Don't text and drive. If you do get into an accident and someone dies, you'll go to jail.
So, okay, what do you guys agree with Scott? Disagree? What do you guys say?
Yeah, I certainly would. It's no different than just like you said, drinking and driving, and then you kill somebody. Well, I mean, you may not. It's even worse because when you're drunk, you're not really in control. He was really sober. That he chose to be distracted while he was driving caused someone else to die.
So Shmuel is saying he's even worse than drinking and driving. In that case, he was the drunk driver was unaware. Here, he's aware, but he elected to be distracted, and therefore converting his car into a weapon. Right. So,
Yeah, it seems like the scale of time is a lot different when you're drunk. And that's what the thing is. That's what the campaign seems to like bring across. Like, when you drink now, you're still going to be impaired in 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, whatever it is, depending on your size and how much you drink. Texting and driving, it's like an instant thing. Like, oh, I can look away for half a second and read this text message.
Right. So it's not really, so that's the chiddush. First of all, it's not a half a, we feel it's a half a second. Also, what does this presuppose about how we judge ourselves? How good are we at judging our capacities and skills?
Not great. We think we can do more than we can.
Yeah, why is that?
I don't know. We're just overconfident.
Why do so many people feel this measure of overconfidence?
Because it's like, oh, I've been driving for years. Like, you know, I can look down at my phone and text and do 70 miles on the highway. Like, I'm a skilled driver.
Right. So, interesting, when I took a defensive driving course in New York State to get some points shaved off my license, the latest New York law, which I'm not sure everybody's aware of, that you're not allowed to even touch your phone. You can't hold it. It can't be touching your body. It can't be on your lap. If a cop pulls you over and sees that you're holding the phone, not even talking, not even texting, not even reading it, holding it, or it's even on your person, they can give you 5 points and up to a $200 fine for holding the phone. Now the question is, I'm not reading anything. Why are they forbidding holding it? I can't even touch it.
Because just holding it, if the screen lights up or it buzzes or it dings, is going to tempt you to look at it.
Oh, okay, correct. In other words, the nature of the phone is designed to grab your attention, to draw you in. All right? That's what the idea of the phone is. Hey, did my friends text me back? You know, how long do you feel frustrated when you send a text to somebody? How long do you feel, at what point do you feel frustrated when they have not texted you back? Shmuel, how long do you feel frustrated when you text a friend and they've not texted you back? At what point?
In the time that it asked me that till this moment is how long my patience is.
Once you see that read receipt.
Okay, it's the title.
So basically like 5 seconds, 10 seconds. How about you, Shana? What do you say?
Yeah, I'm joking. But yeah, within a few minutes, you start wondering, what's the deal?
Shana, what about you, Shana?
Depends on the friend. Or depends on the person. Some people I know are slow to respond. Some people I know are quick to respond. And depending on what I know the other person is doing at that time.
So let's say it's with a quick texter who you know is available. At what point do you feel annoyed with them if they don't text you back?
More concerned that something's wrong than annoyed.
Okay. All right. We're gonna go to Suzanne. This is a great question. I'm curious. What do you got, Suzanne? At what point do you get feel that first tint of frustration? But you're on mute. We don't hear you. Now you're on mute. I don't know. You were on mute before, but I don't want to hear you. Something's. We can't hear you for some reason. Now we can.
Now you can hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay. I'm a few seconds. And I have a friend who will text me. I'll text right back, and then she disappears. And that drives me nuts. You just texted me. I know you're there.
The otherwise known as the old ghosting on you. Right. So that's part of the deal, is that when we get a text, when we're driving, you know, we feel that need that, oh, we got to see what's going on. We got to be in the know. We got to, you know. Now, going back to the point earlier, as Scott pointed out, that we have this enlarged and exaggerated sense of our own personal skill and capacity. Of course we can drive 55 miles an hour down the highway while reading text messages and actually doing text messages on our right hand. That's reasonable. We can do that. Part of that exaggerated sense of our capacity is part of our way, sort of a overcompensation for the fact that we might feel weak. So we exaggerate our skills and our capacities. In reality, it's not the case. So that could be a factor. Now, it's interesting that the New York State made the same rule that the Torah made. The Torah forbids affectionate touch. New York State forbids touching the cell phone. How is it, compare the, what's the idea? Is there a comparison to be made or not?
Yeah, if you give an inch, you'll take a mile.
Right, the nature of both activities is to draw you in. In other words, the nature of cell phone use or smartphone use is to utilize it, is to get more engrossed in it. So New York State said also the issue of to make it easier for the police to make a clear case, because I can say, oh, I was holding the phone, but I wasn't reading the phone. So to avoid all the, you know, unclarity, they also made that rule. In other words, you can't look at it. You can't even hold it. So too, the Torah forbade, if the Torah's interest was to forbade sexuality between unmarried people, so prohibiting sexual affectionate touch makes sense, because the nature is not just to, the nature of that activity is to be drawn in on that. So too by Yichud, being alone, you know, or being alone in an apartment, it could be innocuous, but the nature of two, a male and a female, you don't really know. You don't know what's going to draw you in, what's not going to draw you in. So therefore the Torah said not to participate in that. Why do you think that phone negia in the state of New York has such a severe punishment, 5 points and $200?
To discourage people from doing it.
Or because people die. Frequently, the person themselves are distracted and they will crash into a tree or will crash into us, you know, into a wall of, or they themselves will injure themselves. So it's really to protect themselves. I want to go to another video related to this. Let's go to the videotape. All right. So what is it about, by extension, what is it about drinking that you can rationalize? Like, I only had a drink. I had one drink. What's the rationalization there? And why is the such a strong campaign against that?
The rationalization on one drink is I don't feel drunk. I still have my wits about me. I can still walk a straight line. I don't feel like I feel the alcohol.
Right. So apparently, we're not good judges of that. So the reality is, buzz versus drunk. Very simply, if you get pulled over and you have a blood, you know, state, there's a different 0.08, whatever, 0.1, whatever the state limit of your town is, then you're defined as, you know, you're drunk, you know, driving while intoxicated, DWI, and, you know, you're going to be taken you're going to be taken to Pound Town, because again, that just simply kills people. Now we're going to transition about what the Torah talks about, says about that. Let's get on to the halakha here. Let's go to one. Sorry about that. All right, you guys see the sheet?
Yes.
All right, good. All right, yeah, so let's have our Mendel read it out. The halakha. What's the Rambam?
Rambam, the laws of injury and damages, tort law, chapter 1, halakha 11. A man is considered mu'ad at all times, whether acting intentionally or unintentionally, whether asleep or awake or intoxicated. If he injures a colleague or damages a colleague's property, he must always reimburse him from his choicest property.
Okay. This is something that people be unaware of. Halakhically, you're always liable. If you do damage, whether you do muad means that you're assumed to be a damager. So since you're viewed as a damaging being, you have to be extremely careful. Whether you're acting, you know, whether you did it purposefully or by accident, whether you're awake, whether you're asleep, whether you're drunk, you're always responsible. Whatever any outcome of your action, intended or otherwise, you gotta pay. So a person's drunk or intoxicated or distracted and smashes into another, smashes and breaks a house or property, according to Halacha, you're 100% responsible. Now, okay. Now we're gonna get into this week's parsha. We're going to scroll back to that citation. Let's do another halacha about being careful. All right, Shmuel, you want to read?
Sure. We're starting at Rambam laws of the murderer?
Yeah.
Okay. Rambam laws of the murderer and preserving life, 114. Whenever a person can save another person's life, but he fails to do so, he transgresses a negative commandment. As Leviticus 19:16 states, do not stand idly by while your brother's blood is at stake. Similarly, this commandment applies when a person sees a colleague drowning at sea or being attacked by robbers or a wild animal, and he can save himself or he can hire others to save him. Similarly, it applies when he hears Gentiles or Muslim conspiring to harm a colleague or planning a snare for him and he does not inform him and notify him of the danger. And it applies when a person knows of a Gentile or a man of force who has a complaint against a colleague and he can appease the aggressor on behalf of his colleague, but he fails to do so. And similarly, in all analogous instances, a person who fails to act transgresses the commandment, do not stand idly by while your brother's blood is at stake.
So in contrast to America, where we have the doctrine of the Good Samaritan law from the New Testament, that the guy was a Good Samaritan because he helped out, here the Torah says, do not stand idly by. Don't stand on your brother's blood. So anytime a person is in danger and you can help them out, you got to do it. So let's say, simple case, it's the summertime. There's a kid in the pool, but you're dressed in a beautiful suit and gorgeous shoes and everything. And the kid's struggling in the pool. And the bottom line is, what do you got to do? What do you got to do?
You got to step in and help.
You got to jump in, even if it means if your clothes get ruined.
Well.
No, not well, 100%.
You can't hire someone to help them.
It doesn't seem a situation where the hiring would be really pertinent.
Now, I like the idea of that, though.
You can make a Craigslist listing.
Right. My friend is being attacked by lions. Who would like to help him?
Right. But we're talking about situations where, where obviously in a time-sensitive situation where a person can, you know, hire somebody, go out into the boat and to save somebody. You know what I'm saying? So,
don't some states have like Good Samaritan laws? Or like you?
No, but the Good Samaritan law is exactly that. Like it's an optional. Like you're a good guy if you do it.
The good.
It's not like you're a good guy. That's the basic requirement of being a good Jew. A good Jew will always will make sure that their fellow person is out of danger. I'm going to give you a dramatic example.
Right.
You were going to go to the dramatic example that's happened in Israel. It's a little bit disturbing footage, but it's only for a minute. But I want to show you the idea. And it happens in Israel all too often. It doesn't have any sound, so you got to watch it. Okay? There's a guy rammed that person in. There's the Palestinians ramming the person in at the bus stop. This happened a number of times 2-3 years ago. The guy's getting out of the car, then he's going for the person who's singing, then he's now with a hatchet stabbing the guy, both guys. Now, here's the guy. See the guy coming up? This is a guy who is with a gun, just pulls a gun and is shooting the attacker. But the attacker is what? Getting up and tried to throw the blade at him. I don't know why he didn't shoot him again. Whatever. Guy's getting up again. This guy's like,
he's probably wearing some kind of body armor.
All right. So now the police show up. Guy's getting up again. Another guy pushes him. Another guy pushing him. And the guy shoots him. And here comes the army. I don't know why they could not get the guy down. All right, then now everybody's coming in. Here comes the army guys. All right. My point being of that disturbing video is very simple. Here's a guy. Here, this happened in many situations where you have many, many terrorist attacks in Israel were stopped not by the police or the army, but was a guy who was, now in Israel, everybody's an ex-army guy who is carrying around a weapon and went in and basically stopped the terrorist, either wounded him until the authorities came or actually had to shoot him and kill him. That's a mitzvah. Now that guy, by the way, you saw the guy was in danger because that guy was not going down. I don't know the particulars. He had a weapon. He had a sharp knife, a hatchet rather. And his goal was to kill as many Jews as he could before being killed. So that's the. That's the mitzvah in the most stark terms. That basically. Now the question is why. What's animating this? This goes back to the verse in Noah. Only the blood of your life will I demand on account. If I demand such account from the hands of every wild beast, he who spills human blood shall have his own blood spilled by man, for God made man in his own image. In other words, it's due to the fact that we look at a person not as a mammal, a sophisticated mammal, but since he has a Tzelem Elohim, the divine image, we have to nourish that and take care of that. And you have to go out of your way and take and protect the person or rescue a person. Now, this is all introduction to understand a very interesting mitzvah which we have in this week's parsha. Let's have, remember, read it out. Refuge cities and murder.
Refuge cities and murder. Chapter 35, verse 9. God spoke to Moshe, telling him to speak to the Israelites and say to them, "Now that you are crossing the Jordan into the land of Canaan, you must designate towns which shall serve you as refuge cities, to which a murderer who killed a person accidentally can flee. These cities shall serve you as a refuge from the avenger, so that a murderer not die until he can stand trial before the courts. The towns that you provide for yourselves shall be six in all. As refuge cities, you shall provide the three towns on this side of the Jordan and three in the land of Canaan. These cities shall be a place of refuge for both the proselyte and residents among the Israelites. so that anyone who accidentally kills a person shall be able to escape there. Of course, if one strikes his victim purposely with an iron weapon, killing him, then he is a murderer and he should be put to death for murder. And he must be put to death for murder. Similarly, if he strikes with a handheld stone that can be a deadly weapon and the victim dies, he is a murderer and must be put to death for murder. Likewise, if he strikes with a deadly wooden hand weapon, if the victim die and the victim dies, he is a murderer and must be put to death for murder. In such cases, after the trial, the blood avenger shall kill the murderer, and he can kill it wherever he finds it. The same law applies if the killer pushes down his victim or throws something down on him with hatred, causing the victim to die. This is also true if he maliciously strikes him with his hand, causing the victim to die. The person dealing the blow is a murderer and he must be put to death. Once he has been tried, the blood avenger shall kill him wherever he finds him. This is not true, however, if the killer pushes down his victim accidentally and without malice, or throws an object at him without planning to kill him. Even if it is a stone that can kill, if he did not see the victim and it killed him by falling on him, he is not a murderer, since he was not an enemy and did not bear his victim any malice. In such cases, the court shall follow these laws and judge between the killer and the blood avenger. The court shall protect the accidental murderer from the blood avenger and return him to the refuge city to which he fled. The victim must live there until the death of the high priest anointed with the sacred oil. If the killer goes outside the boundaries of the refuge city to which he fled, and the blood avenger finds him outside the borders of his refuge city, then if the blood avenger puts the killer to death, it is not an act of murder. The killer is thus obligated to live in his refuge city until the high priest dies. After the high priest dies, the killer may return to his hereditary land. These shall be the rules of law for you for all your generations, no matter where you may live.
Okay, that's a whole lot. Okay. All right, so let's clarify that. Okay, so the Torah conveys, what are the two categories of murder?
Purposeful and accidental.
Purposeful and accidental, correct. Now, and what's the basic rule if a person kills somebody on purpose, maliciously? They have to put to death. Now, in the book of Devarim, it adds the fact that, of course, requires two witnesses that witnessed it, and also there's a phenomenon of warning. So a person who murders has to be warned and has to be witnessed that he does it. Okay? So it's not mentioning that part there. Okay? It's not just if you got, you know, you have to have evidence. And the only evidence for capital case is that two witnesses see the event. Okay? What's the other example? What's the other case? Now, by the way, there's this other person. Who's the blood avenger? The Hebrew word is Goel Hadam, literally the blood, the redeemer of the blood. Who's that? The Torah, does anybody know who that's referring to?
That's the last thing I just read, no?
Yeah, who is the blood avenger?
An immediate relative of the victim.
Exactly. That's, by the way, a cool name for a movie. The Blood Avenger. I'm sure it is a new movie. The Blood Avenger. So the Blood Avenger, or the Hebrew, is the Goel Adam. In the case of a purposeful murder, he actually is the one, if after there's a conviction, he's the one that does the capital punishment. Do you know what the capital punishment for intentional premeditated murder is in Judaism? Anybody want to get
stoning?
What?
Stoning?
Stoning's good? No.
Is it the one with the fire?
Not burning, no.
The one with the sword?
The one with the sword. The old, good old-fashioned decapitation. That's it. That's what's called in the comma. It's called revenge.
What's the fourth one?
We missed strangulation.
Strangulation, that's it.
You know, put the rope around the person's head, tie it to two horses, they go in opposite direction. Good night, goodbye, farewell, over. Okay, this is not a, this is, by the way, I apologize in advance. This is a PG-13 for violence class. It is part of the terror, huh? We deal with
it becomes, everything. I guess it becomes mature when you have to describe Serafa.
Right. I'm not doing this right for them. They pour down hot mold lead down the person's throat. So by the, just the Talmud says, just since the laws of the of adjudicating are so complicated, a court that's killed two people in 70 years is called the bloody court. So it's an interesting phenomenon. In regards to on the books, there's the capital punishment. But as far as the adjudication, there's a lot of rachamim woven in. Okay, we're gonna. That's an important point. Now, then we have the interesting case: the person who kills by accident. Okay. Now, I didn't ring down the halacha. Basically, there are three categories of by accident. Without me telling you, what do you think the three cases of accident are? Use your own, and it's completely logical. I think you can figure it out. Of killing somebody by accident, and they have luckily have three different outcomes.
Well, there's texting by driving.
Well, that's an interesting. Okay, but that's an interesting question because that would fit into one of the three categories of quote unquote by accident. Logically, what can you think of as different cases of by accident? We use that word in a very generic way. The Hebrew word is hahoreg beshogeg, by accident.
Are you talking about specific examples of how one can kill somebody by accident?
Or you could say that it could be further broken down to three different categories.
Isn't there something where someone's animal accidentally kills someone?
That's an animal, what they call a short tom, and an ox is not assumed to be a gore, and in fact does gore. That's one rule. Versus the muad, he's assumed to be a gore, or it's assumed to be a vicious dog, let's say, and you don't properly fence him in, you're responsible for all the damage done. I'm talking about human action. Logically, how you can organize by accident?
You say you didn't set out to kill someone, but as a result of your actions, somebody was killed?
Well, that's all the three cases. You kill by accident, the result, you didn't, by accident, always have to have that your intent was not to kill somebody. But the net result is you did kill somebody.
Like if a machine malfunctions and as a result, someone dies, like your brakes fail and it's a recall.
Okay, so Suzanne has the first category, which is a shogeg karav l'ones, which is a by accident, which is close to essentially against not, basically you were forced into it. For example, you are working, as you said, you were driving a car, it was properly maintained, and somebody's crossing the street, and you hit the brakes, and the brakes don't respond, and you had no reason to believe they would not be a thing. So that, and the person gets injured, God forbid, then that's, you're exempt. Okay? We'll get to what they do in those three cases. You know what I'm saying? It's by accident, but it's essentially deemed as basically being, you were forced into it, basically completely not your fault. Then there's the middle case. What's the middle case, which is a classic case here? Let's use the car analogy again.
Negligence.
What's the negligence? Make it very
You're responsible for something. For me,
you're responsible. You didn't do it intentionally. What's the case? What's the category?
Maybe recklessness. Well, I guess that's the same thing.
Yes. Would you call an example? What you call it was by accident, but you were negligent. For example, you're using a very old lawnmower. which has not been serviced for a long time. And the blade shoots off and strikes somebody. What's negligent about that? Why is that called? You didn't do it on purpose. You didn't, you know, want to kill the person.
Because you didn't maintain it regularly.
Right, because you had a duty to do what?
To inspect it. Keep it working, yeah.
And to ensure that it's in good, proper working order. But you used it anyways. So that's a classic case of shogig. Shogig is that somebody was hurt or was killed, God forbid. And you had a duty, you should have known better. The case in Devarim is the guy goes out chopping wood with a loose, where the axe has a loose blade. All right? And the blade shoots off the handle. And like many horror films, finds the guy, that blade finds somebody squarely in the forehead and kills them. Okay? So that is your shogig. You did it by, now you didn't know that your blade is going to shoot up at that moment and kill that guy, but what was the crime? What was the sin? I did not, I knew that it was shaky. I knew it was not well serviced, and I used it anyways, right? Then there's an example where it's a shogig carvel amazed, where it's by accident, which is close to being on purpose. For example, happens tragically in New York pretty often, is that there's a kid on a highway overpass that's dropping rocks. Now, he doesn't know that this rock is going to go through that guy's windshield and kill them, but he's dropping rocks from the overpass where there's a four-lane highway that people are going 60 miles an hour or more. It's just a matter of time that somebody's gonna get hit and they're gonna get killed. That's a shogig carvel amazed, basically the tantamount for being responsible. Okay, now, everybody got that? So the basic principle here of the crime, why, if the guy does it by accident, why is he having any punishment whatsoever? The crime is negligent. And the basic principle is that we have to be concerned about our fellow man to the degree that we have to ensure, if we're doing anything that has any kind of danger whatsoever, we have to ensure that our equipment, our cars, our vehicles, our knives, or anything that could pose a danger to the public is in good working order, you know, is properly maintained and it's safe. Now, so let's go to the case. So based upon that, which one of the three categories would you put in the reading the guy, our first guy, Mr. What's the guy's name? Aaron DeVoe. What kind of shogig is he? Shogig of onus, like totally not his fault. Shogig regular, negligent by accident, or a case where he is negligent, so negligent that basically nearly intentional. Where would you categorize our good friend Aaron DeVoe? What category of shogig is this?
The latter of the three.
What?
The last of the three.
Well, why do you say that?
Because he knows that he's not paying attention. He knows that he's being negligent. That he can't drive the car.
Well, negligent will be the middle category.
Right.
Here, the last category is so negligent that injury is fairly certain.
True, yeah, you're right. Then it would be the second.
So it's the middle. So it's a classic case of shogig because many people text, and it's not absolutely every case or even most cases that people die from that. It does happen. So I would probably put him in he's really the classic case of negligence. He's a negligent murderer, right? He's not definitely a murderer. Like, it's so negligent. It's like, for example, throwing rocks over on a highway overpass, that's not negligent. That's basically by killing somebody by accident, which is nearly approaching intentional. You know what I'm saying? Here, a guy reading his cell phone. I would say less than 50%, less than 60%, maybe only a couple percent where bodily damage is done.
But, Rabbi,
yeah.
There's that woman that killed that actress's baby. She was walking somewhere, I think, in Brooklyn. She was driving and she had a seizure, but I think they're charging her criminally because she had been warned so many times that she had to have known her medical condition was that she should not have been driving, I guess.
Well, so that's a good question. So which one of the three categories of show gig would you put her in? Is it completely not her fault, negligent, or so negligent it's nearly on purpose?
So negligent, because she was warned, you know, multiple times, like, with your condition, you shouldn't be driving a motor vehicle. It's that dangerous.
Right. I don't know the answer, but you know, it's a border case. It's definitely negligent, but how negligent? Nor I don't know how many times has she driven successfully. How often does she get a seizure? You know what I mean? These are the kinds of questions that the Beis Din would judge. Now, what happens like this in Jewish law? In this scenario, the Goel Hadam, the blood avenger, has a right to get you, to kill you, unless you're where?
In the city that you're allowed to, like, flee to for refuge?
The city of refuge, or in Hebrew, the Ir Miklat, okay? When you're in the Ir Miklat, you're safe. It's like the, you know, your safe zone. It's like tag, the safe, the home base, you're safe. Then they transport him to the court that has the jurisdiction of where the crime occurred. Then they do a whole court proceeding, and then they come out. Was it a case of shogeg, which was more like onus, based on his fault? Then he's free, not his fault. Is he a car of lemazed, and then he has to run? And he's not given any protection anywhere. He has a bounty on his head. Okay, well, there's so much, it's a little bit juicy. If he's found to be a standard middle case of shogeg, he was negligent, then he's escorted by two Talmidei Chachamim to the city of refuge. How long does he stay in the city of refuge?
So the current high priest dies.
Which of course is, like, on the surface, bizarre. You know, what's going on with that? Now, this is and if he steps out of the city of refuge, what can happen?
He can be killed by the blood avenger.
So the blood avenger, the Goel Hadam, can kill him. And if he does so, there's no repercussions. He's not a murderer. Okay. What are the obvious questions? And there are many questions on this area, and we have about 8 minutes, so let's see what we can accomplish. What are the questions on this entire mitzvah, on the entire unit?
So why would the blood avenger face no repercussions for killing the unintentional murderer for leaving the city of refuge?
Excellent. If he's negligent, okay, he's not a good guy. But what is this? And in order, if he's really obligated to suffer punishment, so let him get punished. And if he's not, now what is this like? If you're in the Ir Miklat, you're free and you're safe. But if you step your nose out, and you step out of there, you go for a little walk, not so healthy, you can get picked off by the blood avenger sitting there in a machine gun nest. Or rather, in a sniper nest, waiting for you to step out of the boundary of the town of Ir Miklat and pick you off. like American Sniper. Boom. All right. So, sorry about that. A little too graphic. Anyways, make it a little dramatic here tonight. So that's okay. Excellent question. I mean, why is there a blood adventure at all? I mean, isn't revenge bad? I mean, the Torah says, "Lo tikom, you shall not take revenge." How clear can the Torah get? That's question number one. Question number two. Question number three is why is his term, his prison limit determined by the health and well-being of the Kohen Gadol?
Oh, wait, I thought you were saying that's question number one. Question number one was, why is the Avenger allowed to kill him?
Yes.
Question number two is, what is the Blood Avenger in the first place?
How can you have such an institution? It seems to be like crazy.
And then number three is, what's up with the Kohen Gadol?
Right, that seems to be a rather arbitrary connection here. Like, the Kohen Gadol is, living his life. And the fact that he dies or doesn't die, what's it got to do with this individual person, remaining in the Ir Miklat or not?
I mean, I guess building on part of what you were saying, like, what's the whole idea of Ir Miklat in the first place? Why specific cities? I don't understand. Why not just a restraining order? You can't come within 200 feet of this guy or else he can kill you. What's the whole idea of that? There are that many people living in these places. There can be a city or whatever. I mean, what is that?
Okay. Excellent question. Now, these little cities are also, my hint is, I'll give you guys a hint. These cities are, these cities and the cities who are belong to the Leviim are Ir Miklat. So that's my hint.
Don't the Leviim not own land?
They don't own land, but they get cities. They get 42 cities. And the land around 2,000 cubits outside the city limits. They don't have really farming land. They have some pasture land around their cities.
Their food comes from the harvest.
They get, they're principally supported by the tithe of the produce from the regular Jews. So the question is, I think the first thing to start is Ir Miklat. What the heck is that? Is it a city of refuge or a city of rehabilitation? Because the guy who kills by accident, He's not so guilty that he gets the death penalty. He's not murderous, right? But he's also not innocent. The guilt of doing something by accident in general Jewish law was, I was not, let's say for example on Shabbat. Okay, let me have a simple example. Let's say Shabbat, I go into the bathroom I wake up in the middle of the night and I turn off on the light on Shabbat. So what was my negligence? Well, I failed to remember that it's Shabbos, or I failed to remember that on Shabbos I don't turn on the light. But it's a failure being diligent. Now, if I'm completely sleepy, whatever, it might be, what they say, karv la'onas, similar to like not my fault. If I brush up against a light and I turn off a light, I'm not responsible for that. It's an involuntary action. So here, the shogeg lacks, and he has, what's his fundamental flaw? I ask you, what do you guys say? What's the shogeg's fundamental flaw?
Awareness and focus on what's going on around him and what he's doing.
But it's only for the law killing people. He could be unaware about other things. He doesn't get put in, in other words, The guy gets into the city of refuge. The Gemara says he goes into exile. He goes into galut. He's exiled from his hometown and he goes into the city of refuge. So fundamentally, what's trying to be done here is for him to have this basically a kind of a, basically in our own contemporary terms, the Ir Miklat for him is a halfway house. He lives in a city, not his own. His movement is restricted. and he recognized he has to, and basically what's the goal? He has to think deeply into his action, and he has to do teshuva. Okay? Now, one idea, and there are many ideas, one idea is the Kohen Gadol is that now, if you're an Ir Miklat guy, and you're separated from all your friends and family from your ancestral home, what do you want to do? Who do you want to die?
The Kohen Gadol.
You want to, so basically, like, you're davening for the Kohen Gadol to die. Now, in a healthy person, that should bring up the, so now that brings up the conflict. I've already killed one person, but in order for my personal freedom, I want the highest Jew in the land, the Kohen Gadol, to die prematurely so I can go back to my friends. So that also is a tool for him to retrospect, like, you know, what's up with my, why am I so cavalier about human life? Why don't I recognize that there's a Tzelem Elokim in all people and I just don't care about them? Okay? It's a tool of his introspection. Now let's go to the Blood Avenger. What's up with that? That's the question. So now why does the Blood Avenger say, look, you know, my brother Joe, he's a good guy, and he was killed by this idiot, and, you know, and it's just tragic. Why is him being allowed to kill the murderer helping anything? Why is he called an avenger? How could you avenge another person's blood? The guy's dead. You're not going to bring him back. So why isn't the activity itself an act of futility? What is the blood avenger avenging?
The untimely death of his relative.
But he's not going to bring it. But isn't this the height of irrationality, insanity? He's not bringing his brother back.
But it's about justice, right?
Okay, what's the justice? But again,
he's like he's balancing things out. Like, you know what I mean?
How's he? What's the balance? In other words, now instead of having one person dead, now I got two people dead. How did I help anything? He's making the situation worse. What he's avenging, that's why he's called the Goel, means to redeem. He's redeeming the blood of his brother. Because fundamentally, his brother was, you know, walking nicely, having a little tiyul in the forest, and this dude was using unsafe machinery, and his brother Joe got killed. And what is it, and it made his brother's existence like, his death to be like cheap. One of the ideas we have, my principle, is that Rabbi Soloveitchik said it beautifully. One of the blessings of the state of Israel is that no longer will the Jewish people's blood be cheap. Because if the enemies of Israel kill Jews, there'll be consequences. And therefore, a Jew's passing into the night will not be something that simply is irrelevant. Nothing, you know, zero. So in a certain sense, he's marking the fact that my brother's death is not so insignificant. That was a Tzelem Elokim that was snuffed out in an untimely fashion. Now that's right, it's not vigilantism, it's regulated by the court. So if the guy's in the program, if the shogay guy's in the program in his halfway house in the Ir Miklat, you can't touch him. But if he's going to step out, then the Goel Adam is going to participate to articulate this idea that that Jewish blood is not cheap. It's another value. That this person had a Tzelem Elokim, and the fact that he got snuffed out is not right. Not right. So there's a balance going on here between rehabilitation of the negligent murderer and the maintaining the principle that a person's existence and significance is very valuable. And if the person is going to be, left to just go through his regular life, and even though he's killed his brother, there's an injustice there, as Scott was pointing out. The injustice is there that if you're going to live life normally and that's it, you're basically saying that my brother's existence was insignificant, irrelevant. So that's not true, because the loss of Atzel and Elohim is a significant foundational loss, especially if it was done with absolute negligence and carelessness. So there's a balance here between the two values. But if the person's in the program to rehabilitate himself, the Goladam has to restrain himself and cannot go into the town and kill him. But if the person is a murderer, he actually, the Goladam does avenge by actually doing what? By being the one of actually doing the execution. Or if he was Karv Lemazin, if the guy was negligent on the edge of being, what do you call it, did on purpose, he may go out and actually find the guy. And the guy has to spend his life running as a fugitive. Okay, so most of us, God willing, are not having to deal with cases of murder and being fugitives and negligent homicide, I hope. But one thing is the value which we take home here is that we as the Jewish people have a view human life as being sacred, because the person expresses the idea of a Tzelem Elohim. And if we see a person in danger, we have an obligation even to risk our lives somewhat. How far do you have to go is another question, another class. You see somebody struggling in the pool, you got to fish them out. You got to get wet. You get yourself dirty. You got to do it. And as you saw from the videotape from the terror stack in Jerusalem there, that's, Israelis all the time, even if they're not, let's say they were in the Israeli army, there's no thing, well, I'm off duty now. No, not off duty. There's a Jew that's in danger. You got to help out. Got to step up. And B, the most important practical thing we can do is, going back to the most common thing, texting while driving, reading text while driving, having a l'chaim and the drunk driving, things that don't, as Scott said, they don't feel criminal, but they really can have criminal consequences. And to be vigilant is really something that we struggle, because we don't want to be the rotzeach b'shogeg, the negligent murderer guy, the murdering by accident. But it could happen. So that's where we have, this is also a mitzvah. So my point being is something that you would imagine, being careful not to text and drive is a mitzvah of being conscientious and being concerned for human life and property. And being careful not to be drunk or even too drowsy. Many people have driven, has anybody here driven, has anybody done like an all day drive across a big part of the United States? So there's that emotion, like, I want to get there already. I'm annoyed of driving. So what do? I'll pull in, I'll get myself a super venti, tankard of coffee, and I will just make myself nearly like spastic with caffeine just to power that last 250 miles of driving, right? But the reality is, caffeine can only do so much, and your capacity to be alert and to watch the road, especially if you're doing interstate driving when you're going 65, 70 miles an hour as a regularity or more, it's really this issue. Because you can just you can get drowsy and just move into the other lane, and it's game over. It can be game over for you and the other person. So it's really a mitzvah to be conscientious about these areas. Lo samon al dam riacha, rotzeach b'shogeg. These are, on one hand, very far away from us, but a halakha that applies to us every single day. And ultimately, it hinged upon our appreciation of human life. And therefore, to be concerned about this is a mitzvah, and it's very serious. All right?
I find it strange how frequently I see people who clearly have Bluetooth-capable cars that are still holding their cell phone on their ear and talking on the phone.
Right, because you can understand it. Like, they didn't hook up their phone, and they weren't expecting a call, and they saw, like, oh. Now, by the way, part of it, by the way, comes from a very emotional neediness. Like, oh, my gosh, my friend is calling me. I'm so important. I must speak to them right now. Meanwhile, by me doing that, I'm going to put other people in danger because I'm holding the phone, yakking it off here while I'm driving down the Southern State Parkway. You know what I mean? You know, that's not cool. And I've been guilty of that, you know, myself. It's just because you feel that I got this covered. It's not a problem. It'll be a short call. Won't be a big deal, et cetera. But, these rationalizations, you know, we have to work on ourselves to, you know, not give in to these rationalizations. Because whatever that text is, it's not going away. And if it's very, very important, you can pull over to the side and read it and text back if it's so critical, urgent, whatever. Of course, most cars have Bluetooth where you can connect your phone to the Bluetooth sound system and you can talk. Even though experts say it's not really so much what makes you not effective on the road is not so much holding the phone, it's that your mind is processing the conversation. So if you're having a whole involved schmooze, you know, like I learned with Rabbi Sachs, he has a rule, he will not learn with me if I'm driving. Because we're going to get involved in a whole conversation, you're getting involved in some, you know, intricate whole thing, and meanwhile, like, I'm going, woo, you know, and I'm driving off wherever, not good. So it's not simply the act of talking on the phone, it really about how much of your internal RAM, your bandwidth is being sucked up by what's going on. You know, I mean, technically, you know, you see people like, who have seen people applying their makeup while driving?
Brushing their teeth and shaving.
Right. I shave in the car. I've done that many times. Annoys the heck out of my wife. It's ridiculous. And then she says, and then you're drinking coffee too? Throw the book at me. So, you know, guilty as charged. So the shaving, the, you know, drinking coffee. How many people have eaten breakfast while driving?
AK, yeah, not a hot breakfast. Not a hot breakfast. But
how many people have seen people eat cold cereal out of a cup while driving?
I don't even believe that. That is not possible.
Oh
yes, yeah. I
piece of cake.
Yeah,
I bet somebody's done it.
Driving on Sunday, and that wasn't a sandwich. It required Tupperware and a spoon. So
yeah,
that takes two hands.
No, I used to do community mental health, and I was driving around a lot. I lived in my car.
So if you get, let's say you're on a straightaway on a freeway, you can drive, you can hold your knee, your the wheel on with your knees.
You have to be tall enough.
Okay, fine. So there are ways, all of these activities I have done at various points. I'm trying to be Choser V'tshuva in this area. But yeah, you can do a heck of a lot while driving, or what I'm sharing with you tonight, or so you think. Because you can also turn your car into a, you know, into a 3,000-pound weapon. So that's all right. So that's the idea of the road. There's more stuff in the road safe, but show the whole murder stuff. There's a lot of juicy stuff there. Just parenthetically, one summer I spent a month learning with Rabbi Mann, who also taught in the fellowship back in the day in my yeshiva, and we dealt with this issue, and there's lots of interesting stuff here. I spent a month learning this particular area, you know, going back in the 80s. So there's a lot of juicy, I'm just sort of giving you like a little bit of a, let's call this a Baskins and Robbins teaspoon. I'll give you a, I'll call it a heaping teaspoon. But just to know, just some of the, you know, a little flyby, just to, you know, get a flavor for the issues and relevance. All right, guys, have yourself a great night.
Bye-bye.
I'll see you guys tomorrow.
I have a question. What about the case of mistaken identity where it happened in New York, I think, a couple weeks ago, where the gang members set out to kill one person and then killed somebody else instead?
Yes.
Yeah, it's terrible.
That fall, would that be, is that accidental or is that intentional? And then.
That's an excellent question. You wanted to kill person A, and that's actually, that case is brought down in the halacha. You want to kill person A, but you kill person B. I have to double, I have to relook up. That case is brought down. It's a case. I have to double check the halacha. So I have to double check that. It's a good question. Good question. Yeah, my record, I don't want to guess. I'll look it up and I'll shoot you guys out an email.
Thank you.
You got it. All right, guys, have a great night and I'll see some of you tomorrow.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye. Okay.